Hello and welcome to Sake Revolution, America's first sake podcast. I'm your host, John Puma from thesakenotes.com and all around sake otaku.
And I'm your host, Timothy Sullivan. I'm a sake educator and brand ambassador, as well as the founder of the Urban Sake website. Together, John and I will be tasting and chatting about all things sake.
Tim, the lockdown continues, but the revolution must go on.
I'm glad to hear that. And thanks to technology, you and I don't have to do it alone. We are bringing on our first guest for this episode. We have Mr. Ben Bell on the line with us, and we'll be talking to him about his journey in the world of sake.
Wait. There's no sake education corner this week?
Well, sad to say, but no. Instead, we'll be entering the sake interview nook.
Well, I'm sure the corner will be back next time, and the nook sounds very interesting. Also, I understand that all three of us are going to be tasting and talking about some sake that we brought along today.
Yeah, today's going to be like a potluck style tasting. We're each bringing something fun and unique to the table, and we'll each be introducing our pick.
Fantastic. I cannot wait to see what you guys brought along tonight.
All right, so let's get Ben on the line.
Thank you. Great to be on here. It's an honor to be y'all's first guest.
And that is the voice of Mr. Ben Bell. Ben Bell is well known in the sake industry for having worked in Japan at Nambubijin Brewery, and he's been an all-around cheerleader for the sake industry for a long time. So Ben, we're so happy to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about how you got involved with sake. How did this all start for you?
Yeah, so of course I'm from Arkansas originally, which is an area you may not associate with sake so much, but I started out very young, got a job at a specialty wine shop, and the shop had kind of a good selection of everything, and one day they got in a Junmai Ginjo sake, which I didn't know anything about. I was studying wine pretty seriously at that time, and so I saw this sake. I was intrigued by it. I took it home, and I didn't know how you drink a high quality sake, so I just put it in the fridge, and then I drank it like white wine, and it turned out that was actually maybe the best way to drink that. And I remember thinking it was really interesting, and it was good. I was surprised by how much I enjoyed it, and it got me really intrigued. I think I was particularly intrigued because my home state grows so much rice, number one rice producer in the United States, and I thought something that can taste so delicious and have these fruity notes and be made from rice, it was just really intriguing. And of course, I wanted to know more about it and wanted to know how deep you could go down the rabbit hole of sake.
And you went pretty deep.
yeah. Maybe a little deeper than most.
I would say so.
I started in order to really get out and taste sake, I had to travel. So I started going to sake events in New York. Of course, that was probably in the United States still is the sake mecca. And from there, I've always been interested in production. So, you know, as great as it is to go to a city like New York and taste great sake, you really can't learn. Maybe now you can learn a little bit more, but definitely back then, if you wanted to learn production, there was no way to do it other than to go to Japan, which involves a lot of things, including learning Japanese and being prepared to go live in Japan. So I think when I was taking like my professional certifications with John Gondar and going to those classes, I was always the person who was a little more gunning to go work at a sake brewery and go live in Japan. And that led me to going to work at a fantastic sake brewery called Nambubijin in Iwate Prefecture for 2 years, which was a great experience. Learned a ton.
How did you connect with that brewery in particular?
Yeah, so this is maybe an unexpected connection. I'd been to Japan for a couple weeks to train at a sake brewery, and 2 weeks is good, but I was looking for longer term work, and I came back from that And it just so happened that my the town that I went to high school in, Hot Springs, Arkansas, had a sister city connection in Iwate Prefecture. And that sister city, Hanamaki, is the home of the Nanbutoji Brewing Guild. Maybe among the sake brewing guilds in Japan, it's the biggest and most famous. And Nanbubijin is one of the probably most famous sake breweries that is a part of the Nanbutoji Brewing Guild. So it was actually through an Arkansas sister city connection that I got hooked up with Nanbubijin specifically. I actually couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe my luck that all the breweries I could have maybe gotten hooked up with, it was Nanbubijin, which is, I think, a rightfully famous sake brewery. I used to sell them in Arkansas. And so, yeah, I already knew them by reputation. And, of course, Kosuke Kuji is kind of a luminary in the sake industry. He's an amazing personality. So,
and he's the owner. He's the owner.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Kosuke Kuji is a multi-generational owner.
And I've always experienced their brewery as being open to the outside world. Kuji-san, the owner, he travels very widely internationally and is very open to spreading sake outside of Japan. And I would just imagine that an owner of that type would be more open to welcoming a foreigner into their brewery. Did you experience that?
Yes. So it's kind of famously rare for foreigners to work at sake breweries. And I think some of it could be different brewery owners being wary of having a foreigner come into the sake brewery for any reason. I would say the language barrier is the number one reason why you don't see that very often. But just to even be open to that idea seems to be kind of rare. And I think that's changing now, actually. More breweries in Japan are open to having foreigners come work. But definitely, as I found out from working there and getting to know Kuji-san more over the couple of years, he is a true sake evangelist, and it definitely became apparent that I was part of that evangelism by having this this foreigner, live at the brewery. And of course, I did a lot of interviews and a lot of TV and radio and all that stuff, just talking about my life there. Yeah, it was very interesting.
And when you were learning to make sake there, what was the biggest bit of production that kind of flew in the face of what you expected?
I knew what to expect a little bit from 2 weeks working at another sake brewery in Yamagata Prefecture for a couple of weeks. So I got to go through a work day a few times, and there was a few things that it sort of prepared me for. I think the biggest surprise overall, which I got a taste of before, but it really sets in, I think, when sake brewing becomes your life in Japan, is that the work is very physical. The days can be long. In some cases, you can do what's called overnight work when you're in the koji room making your koji or malted rice, and you get up every couple hours to check on it. Thankfully, Nanbubijin got rid of that work, so I didn't have to do that. But it really instilled in me, I learned to value getting work done quickly. And actually, this will sound maybe strange, but just being stronger. And I think to do your work well, you have to have two things. I think you need to be in pretty good shape, but you need good technique. And all of the technique for all of the jobs just takes a lot of repetition. And of course, as your technique gets better, you don't have to be as strong. You're not using as much energy to do everything. But yeah, even some things like mixing the steamed rice into our main fermentation tanks, that's about 730 kilos that you'll be mixing in on your third edition. And that's over an hour of mixing kind of nonstop, which I would kind of say is, it feels a little like you're running a marathon with your arms. So yeah, that was something. And then of course, aside from that, one of the biggest challenges and learning processes while I was there was slowly overcoming the language barrier in the brewery. It was very hard to be there. And I would say the first couple of months, people would say things to me on a regular basis, and maybe I understood 10% of it. And sometimes people would tell me to do something, and I would think it was the opposite, and I would immediately do the wrong thing. I imagine I was not easy to deal with for quite some time, but I did learn my job, my various tasks there. Towards the end, I had this great feeling of, particularly when people would come to visit the brewery from other countries, they would trust me enough to go do the various jobs, and they say, "Ben, go show them this job." And basically they were saying, while you're doing this job, show it to them, talk them through it. And they knew that I was going to do that job right, and I could, you know, take a little extra time to be, you know, giving folks a good experience while they were there. So that felt great. It felt like towards the end of my 2 years, I was, you know, getting into the swing of things.
You know, our listeners might not know, but I also worked 1 year at a sake brewery, and I had an experience where they set up kind of an educational path for me, and I did every job at the brewery, from, you know, working in the rice milling plants to all the production steps to the bottling facility, even working at the gift shop where they sell the sake to customers. Did you get a chance to do all those different jobs, or did they have you working in one particular area mostly during your time there?
I did all of the jobs. So maybe I think they were trying to give me a similar experience to you, where they wanted me, particularly as a foreigner, to be able to see all of the different jobs. Of course, I was, focused on trying to keep that all in my head to brew in the future. But not only did I get to do that, work on starter batches, grow the kochi, work on main fermentation, steaming, cleaned all kinds of stuff. We actually put together all of those steps into a special batch where I worked on everything from beginning to end, which is kind of rare in the brewery because usually you do specialize in koji making or something like that. And at the end of that, it was Tokubetsu Junmai, and it was labeled with my name, and it was kind of called My Batch. And that was a real special experience. I still have a couple of bottles, empty bottles, back home in Arkansas. So that was a great experience. I will say also, in addition to doing that, maybe this was the biggest surprise for me. It was a thing I didn't expect to do at all. In the summer between brewing seasons, because of course your brewing season typically goes through the winter and summer is your off season, they asked me if I wanted to grow sake rice. And of course, I said, yeah, I would love to. So I worked for the local farming co-op, and I got to grow sake rice from seeds to being in the field, and then see that rice come into the brewery and make sake with it the next year, which I think is about as complete an experience as you can have making sake.
Wow, that's amazing. What an experience.
Yeah. It was fantastic. Being out in the fields. The summers in Japan can be pretty hot and humid, so it's definitely taxing work, but I think it's hard to beat being out in nature, stopping every once in a while and just looking up and seeing the mountains and just the beautiful vistas that Japan has and taking it in. It's a pretty special experience.
Very interesting. Thank you very much, Ben. And now you are here in New York.
Yeah, that's right. So in an unexpected twist, I thought I was, maybe it's a little ironic that, of course, this was the place I used to, the first place I came to learn about sake, and now I'm living here. But yeah, my goal was to start my own sake brewery, and that hasn't happened yet. Instead, my sort of sake journey took me here to New York because this is the kind of the best place to apply your sake skills. So yeah, I'm here. I'm not going out very much these days, but yeah.
Well, I don't think any of us are.
Yeah. Right.
Well, what job or experience brought you here to work in the sake industry?
Yes. So I got a job. I was very lucky to get a job working for Skernick Wines and Spirits, which was a fantastic importer and distributor that I've known from my days working drinks retail in Arkansas, and they were building up their sake and shochu program. I was asked to come on and be the number two person for their Japan portfolio. So, yeah, that was one of the easier yeses, I feel like, for a job, and it's been fantastic. So I've worked in retail, I've worked in restaurants, and I've worked in production. Distributing and importing is the only part that I haven't gotten to do until now. So I feel like it's really filling out the gaps there. And yeah, it's great. It's a great place to work.
Fantastic. So I hear you brought along some sake.
Yeah, that's true. I always have sake close by these days. I have a sake called Atago no Matsu. This is from Nizawa Brewery in Miyagi Prefecture, just north of Sendai. And this is a very interesting brewery. Atago no Matsu is a tokubetsu honjozo. The tokubetsu part, you may have talked about this in a previous episode, but it's the tokubetsu special. And if you mill down to an extra quality grade, or if you use dedicated sake rice like Yamada Nishiki or Miyama Nishiki or Omachi, you can say it's tokubetsu or it's special, right? And so in this case, they do it both ways. It's Yamada Nishiki milled down to 60%, but they're still just calling it honjozo. And you get this really surprisingly elegant sake for its quality grade. It's great. I think Nizawa is probably most famous for their sake called Super 7, and then one that upset called Absolute Zero, which is Super 7 is rice that's been milled down to 7% and then made into sake. I think it usually gets a lot of press just because it's extremely difficult and rare to mill down that bar. And then Absolute Zero, they mill down below 1%, which is, to me, it's really just like a technical feat of milling. Someday I'd love to learn how they do that, but that's what they're most known for. But they actually make a wide range of amazing sake, and actually also interestingly have a very young master brewer, part of this new vanguard of master brewers coming up in Japan, who is also a young female master brewer, which is also rare and thankfully growing in Japan. So,
yeah. And one other point I think that you can't skip when talking about that brewery is that their facility was completely destroyed during the March 2011 earthquake.
Yeah.
They had severe damage and they ended up moving to a brand new facility. And to go through that experience and still continue to produce sakes as wide-ranging as the Super 7 and the Less Than Zero and all these amazing sakes and the ones you're going to be tasting today, I just think that's such an amazing feat of perseverance. I really have a lot of respect for that.
Yeah, coming back from that kind of tragedy, especially now, I think it's inspiring for everybody. Throughout the industry to see. Yeah, and of course I lived in Iwate Prefecture, which was also hit hard by that tsunami, and I got to see that as well. Thankfully Nambu Bijin was too far inland to really get hit, but definitely a good number of sake breweries were affected by that.
Well, as is tradition on the show, once we introduce our sakes, we open them up and have a sip and tell the viewers what we're experiencing. So why don't you, as our first guest, go ahead and do that.
Yeah. So I would say this seems to be Nizawa Brewery's style. As I'm getting the nose, they're very sort of what I would call classically fruity these days, as a fruity profile has been part of sake making maybe since the 80s, having the yeast strains that can make these fruity esters. It's become sort of the dominant way to make, higher end sake. And Nizawa really embraces that, but also with this focus on food pairing. So usually you get a nice mix of fruity components and a good umami base. This definitely has that. On the nose, it's tropical fruits. You get some strawberry notes, and then there's a little bit of floral and herbal notes as well.
Nice.
Yeah. And being a honjozo, it doesn't have as much of the deep umami as a junmai. To me, it ends up being just a little lighter, a little more ethereal on the palate. And to me, it's just really lovely. This is just a really lovely drinking experience. It's very, you know, just fruity and nice and classically balanced. Pretty dry, which is great. I like the whole range of sake, everything from umami to umami driven to fruity styles, and I don't mind a decent amount of sweetness. This is I think more on the drier side, and but it gives you enough fruit to give you that impression of a touch of sweetness.
Just to remind our listeners, the honjozo style is alcohol added. So there's a small amount of distilled alcohol added to this style of sake. Do you think that that is impacting the texture at all for you, Ben?
Yeah, I think so. I think the having that added alcohol, to me, I don't know if everybody agrees with this, but I think normally for me, makes the sake a little lighter on the palate. The number one thing that I feel like adding the alcohol does is it makes some of your fruity components on the nose come out a little bit more, and it focuses those. Excuse me, not to get too technical, but the alcohol makes your fruity esters evaporate easier. So I think it allows the sake to show off that range better. I don't know if I'm really describing that well. Sorry.
No, I think that was excellent. Okay. Yeah, we talked about in a previous episode, we talked about how added alcohols can kind of boost aromas. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, those allowing the esters to reach the surface and evaporate a little bit faster does dial up the aroma quite a bit. So that is one thing we look for with those alcohol added grades, honjozo, ginjo, and daiginjo.
Nice. And Tim, what did you bring with you today?
Well, I am also in the north of Japan. I brought a sake from Akita Prefecture. This is called Yuki no Bosha, and it is a Yamahai Junmai. So this is a pure rice style. Again, no added alcohol. And this is a brewery that I had the good fortune to visit a couple times. And Akita is in the north of Japan, and it's known for being very snowy. It's a place where they grow a lot of rice, and there's a lot of well-known sake breweries there too. And Yuki no Bosha has a very, very famous toji as well. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful brewery. This has a rice milling rate of 65%. And again, it's that pure rice style. So I'm going to go ahead and pour some. See what we got on the nose here. So this has a nice, deep, engaging aroma. Some sakes we've had recently have really clean, more clean aromas, but this has a very deep, nice, engaging aroma and very gentle fruits. A little bit of pineapple. It smells like, you know, when you peel the saran wrap off of a fruit salad and you get that little waft of those fruity flavors, a kind of a mix of fruity flavors. You know, it doesn't smell like you've peeled a pineapple, but there's pineapple plus something else, a little bit of apple, maybe some white grape. And it's that lovely combo. Let's give it a taste. Well, the first thing that hits me is the texture. Very, very smooth. For a sake that's milled to 65%, you might expect a little bit more body, a little bit more structure, but it is very silky smooth. If I was blind tasting this, I would guess this would be a higher grade of sake than just the junmai, but really, really smooth. That's the first thing that hits me. And the finish does linger a little bit, so it's a little bit of a wine-like finish in that regard, that you get a lingering flavors and aromas that don't just disappear. And that's something that is can be really special, especially when you're pairing it with food. And, you know, overall, clean, smooth, really delicious, and some very gentle fruity flavors on the palate. So it's a winner in my book.
Really happy about that.
And John, what do you have today?
I'm keeping the dream of Northern Japan sake alive on the show, and I brought this Otokoyama Shibotate Tokubetsu Junmai Nama Genshu. I wanted to get as many words in the title as I possibly could, and this is what I came up with. I call this
kind of kitchen sink sake. A little bit of everything thrown in.
We'll go into what these mean in a little more depth in a future episode. But what I will say is that Genshu is cask strength, and we did go over that slightly in a previous episode. So since this is undiluted, or I use that slang, cask strength, it is 17% as opposed to the usual 15-16 that you usually see from sake. Now, the interesting thing is I have not visited this brewery, but I did visit Hokkaido for the first time very recently. And even though I was in prime Otokoyama country at the prime Otokoyama country time of the year, I didn't get to try this. So kind of making up for that now.
So this is a bottle you brought back?
No, this is not a bottle I brought back from Japan. This is a bottle I purchased recently in America. So it was bottled in December. And now I realize that time has lost a lot of its meaning for people now in quarantine, but yeah, it's a couple of months old now. And it does have a very strong Nama note to it, which is unpasteurized. You can smell that raw flavor. You can smell that raw like scent as soon as you put your nose anywhere near the glass, it just comes out. And Tim, as you said, this is very much the kitchen sink. I mean, it's a little bit sweet. It's a little bit fruity. It's not dry. There's no dryness at all. But it is very big, very active. It's got a strong kind of a aggressive berry note to it. So not like strawberry per se, but maybe raspberry. And just kind of like, again, it's just really, really intense with that.
Yeah. So your sake is a nama. In Japanese, the word nama literally means raw. But in this case, it's, again, as you said, unpasteurized. And that really, for me, signals something kind of juicy and very, very dense and fresh, bright. I sometimes call it green sake, meaning like, not yet ripe or not yet mellowed.
It's almost overwhelming.
Ben, you probably have some experience with nama sake as well. Did you get it to drink a lot of that when you were working at the Nambu Beach and Brewery?
One of the perks of working at a brewery is unpasteurized sake is kind of everywhere. And yeah, I think you get to experience a good number of things like that, things that are unfined, unfiltered. Of course, that people, I think before you would only find that kind of sake sold around the brewery, and then everything that was really shipped out to Tokyo or overseas is, it's going to be pasteurized, so it makes the trip better, it stays on the shelf better. But people are more into those styles these days, so I think they're getting out more. But of course, yeah, I would have a good amount of namazake, and I think also one of the fantastic things about working at a sake brewery is we will do local events and pull out amazingly rare sakes that you kind of see, you almost never see for sale in other cities. And of course, we're just enjoying it. Some regular dinner, just a great experience.
Fantastic.
Yeah, you said it was such hard work, physical labor to work at a sake brewery, which I totally understand. But one of the perks you get is to drink all those fresh,
oh my goodness,
nama, unpasteurized sakes right from the plants. It's just amazing. And that's something, honestly, you can only experience in Japan if you want it from a
Japanese brewery. I would say maybe the best sake I've ever tasted in my life was sake that we were pressing. We were using the Shizuku style of pressing, where you put the mash into bags and hang it. And it's just gravity that's pulling the sake through the bag, And I got to taste a little bit of the sake as it dripped out of the tank from the it's basically kind of its holding tank, and it was dripping down into the big bottles where it was going to be stored. And I got to take just a little bit of that and drink it, and it was such an amazing experience. I think it was the quality of the sake was fantastic, but just to be tasting it at that exact moment felt really special too. It was kind of all those things put together. It's one of the things that you can't experience unless you go visit a brewery, and even then you got to kind of catch them at the right time when they're doing something like that.
Well, Ben, our time here is drawing to a close. It was such a pleasure to have you on our show as our very first guest. Just a delight to talk with you.
Y'all, thank you so much for having me on. This has been great. And congratulations for getting this podcast going. I know you've been thinking about it for a while, and I think it's going to be a credit to the sake community.
Yeah, and you'll have to come back on again, and we'll try another trio of sakes together. This was a lot of fun. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. Thank you all so much for tuning in. If you can, take a moment to rate our show on Apple Podcasts.
And we don't want you to miss an episode any more than you do, so make sure that you subscribe wherever you download your podcasts.
To learn more about Ben or any of the sakes that we tasted in today's episode, be sure to visit our show notes or simply visit sakerevolution.com.
And if you wanted to send us any feedback or show ideas, people you want to see interviewed, drop us an email at feedback@sakerevolution.com.
So until next time, remember to keep drinking sake and
Kanpai! Kanpai.